I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome to Radio Times. There is still much confusion and many questions about what caused the crash of the Malaysia Airlines plane yesterday in Ukraine. All of the passengers on board were killed, including about 100 researchers, health workers, and activists headed to the International AIDS Conference in Melbourne, Australia. The scientific community is stunned, in grief, and concerned about the impact on future research. HIV/AIDS has confounded scientists since it was first identified back in the 1980s, but there has been significant progress, including the fact that many are living with the disease, not dying from it. We want to take stock of where we stand in the battle against this epidemic. About a million Americans test positive for HIV, and there are about 50,000 new cases every year. We have three guests who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studio. Let me introduce them to you. Gary Bell is executive director of BEBASHI, which stands for Blacks Educating Blacks About Sexual Health Issues. That's a case management agency that serves low-income people of color with HIV disease in Philadelphia. Gary, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
Also with us is Ian Frank, and he's director of the Clinical Therapeutics Program at the Penn Center for AIDS Research. Ian Frank, nice to have you with us.
Thanks, Marty. Good morning.
And good morning. And also with us is Jose DeMarco. He's a community organizer for ACT UP Philadelphia. Jose, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Nice to be here.
Nice to have all three of you here. And Ian, if I could begin with you and begin with this plane crash. And frankly, I was shocked when I read this morning about 100 people on their way to this AIDS conference in Melbourne, Australia, have died, including researchers and activists and health workers. What do you think the impact will be on things like research and even on the community involved in AIDS?
Well, probably the most prominent HIV investigator in the Netherlands, Jaap Langer, died, and there were a lot of public health officials and activists. I think it's going to have a huge impact on HIV care and research in the Netherlands. Langer was an inspirational guy, very much involved in organizing the pharmaceutical industry to make medications available in the developing world. And the organization that he founded and he's led since its inception, I think, is also going to suffer. And this is a huge tragedy. Mm-hmm. Obviously, it's a tragedy for everybody who
Indeed.
Lost their lives and their families and friends. But the HIV community has taken a huge blow here.
To you, Gary, and you've been on the show a number of times over mm-hmm. the years talking about HIV/AIDS. Where do we stand when it comes to even our understanding of the disease? From your perspective on the ground, you deal with people here in the city of Philadelphia.
Well, one of the disturbing things is a conversation I have just about every week that because people don't hear about HIV very much, that they think it's not a problem anymore. And I have that conversation over and over again because they just feel that, well, first of all, people really don't want to think that much about it. They don't want to necessarily change their behaviors and so forth. But I really think that people are believe that it's really under control. And we're going to talk a little bit about today about
yes,
how it's
will.
Not really under control.
Indeed. And Jose, I'm curious about your experience, even from your work here in Philadelphia. And some have said, you know, going back to the 80s and 90s, it was essentially a death sentence. Today, it's not so much a death sentence. Has that changed people's thinking about HIV/AIDS?
Yeah, a lot of people, because of the new medications and the treatment, I think younger people, this is my personal opinion,
absolutely.
Younger people did not live through the Holocaust. I like to term it that. I shouldn't appropriate that word, but I lived through a Holocaust where I saw my whole community die, literally in front of my eyes. And young people tend to think that this disease will not affect them. And when you're young, you think you're
invincible.
You're
right?
Invincible, yeah. And young people, especially young men of color, MSM community, we call it men having sex with men, didn't live through that. So nor do they realize the horror, everything that goes along with that. But mm-hmm. folks think, I can take a pill and I'll be all right. But it's, you know, it's a world of difference to take medication every day that has side effects, and not only that, to be able to even afford it for the rest of your life.
Which so. I do want to pick up on. I mean, it is so curious, Ian, because, you know, Jose talks about the Holocaust, the time when so many people were dying of AIDS, and there was so much sort of public health response to that. And now what I'm hearing from actually from the two of our guests here is it's sort of gone underground. Go ahead.
I'm sorry, I meant to correct myself. This Holocaust is still going on in South Africa, and I meant to correct that. I'm just thinking here locally in the Philadelphia in the United States, but it is a global epidemic that's still going on.
Indeed it is. I mean, should we think of it as a chronic disease? Is that helpful? Is that the truth?
It is the truth. HIV therapy is the miracle in medical therapeutics these days. When I first started to take care of people with HIV in 1987, there was almost nothing I could offer them. I could prevent the complications that they would inevitably get, but they would get one, then another, and eventually I knew they were all going to die. Now, a new person coming into care, I can prescribe one pill one time a day, no side effects, and an individual can stay on that regimen for 50 years and live with this disease and die of a heart attack or cancer or whatever people die of when they're in their 70s or 80s.
So a regular long life?
Live a regular, normal life. I would rather have HIV than diabetes. Diabetes will kill you. HIV does not need to kill you anymore.
But I can understand or imagine someone hearing you say that, thinking, okay, then I don't need to take precautions.
Well, and this is part of the problem that we have. On the one hand, we want people to understand it's okay to be diagnosed with HIV, it's okay to come in to get medical care, don't be afraid of that. The treatments are key not only to keep people alive and healthy with HIV, but to prevent them from transmitting their infection to their partners. Because when somebody's viral load is undetectable, which means they're on therapy and we can't measure any replicating virus in their bloodstream, they don't transmit their virus to others. So a key component of prevention is to treat people who have HIV. Mm. And we want people to know that. We want to get that word out. We want to encourage people to get on medication. But nobody wants to have HIV infection. Nobody wants any medical problems. Nobody wants to have to take any medication. And the Achilles heel in the whole equation is that HIV can develop resistance to the medications we use if people don't take them appropriately, if people miss doses. And especially younger people with the disease, younger people who don't take medications may not worry about the consequences of a few missed doses. The next regimen I prescribe, if somebody's virus develops resistance, isn't as easy to take. And subsequent regimens are not as easy to take and may be more likely to have side effects. So doing it right the first time is really key. And that becomes a challenge, and, you know, Jose or Gary may have better perspectives
sure.
on that.
Sure. Well, even picking up what you both said, and to you, Gary, which is if we're talking about 50,000 new cases a year in the United States, is there a picture, a profile of those people who are getting AIDS?
The profile is that about 44% of the new infections are in African Americans. In Philadelphia, it's about 62% of the new infections. And if you were to look at the highest risk group at the moment, it's a young African-American man that has sex with other men. So, and just the challenge now, while we have these great medications, is keeping people in care. Getting people in care, about 18% of people who are HIV positive do not know it. And only about 50% of the people who are HIV positive are retained and in care and taking antiretrovirals. And that number drops as you get into certain populations, particularly African American.
Is it because they don't know that they might be at risk for contracting the disease? I mean, why do they not take protections? What explains, you think, the fact that people are still getting HIV AIDS?
Well, with the people who are HIV positive already and are not in care, that has a host of social, what we call social determinants of care, unemployment, lack of access to care, homelessness, substance abuse, we can go on and on. But for a lot of the people who do not know they're HIV positive, some of it is a perception of risk. Some of it is just people feeling that they just don't need to get tested. And so there's still a lot of people, especially younger people, who just don't feel that they're at risk.
You want to add to that, Jose?
Yeah, those are a lot of the campaigns that ACT UP Philadelphia is working on. Homelessness is a really big issue. And not only that, people don't realize that housing someone is HIV prevention. And, yeah.
Oh, the idea of if someone has a house, there's a greater chance they will not contract the disease.
And a greater chance that they will not transmit HIV. People that are homeless will do a lot of things to get off of the street when it's cold or extremely hot. And there are predatory people that take advantage of folks like that, and they have no power, negotiating power in a relationship, a sexual relationship. So this happens an awful lot. There's stigma, which, you know, talk about people are afraid to be tested because in communities of color, you're seen as being gay or homosexual. There are just a lot of social determinants. And in communities of color, and African-American and Latino communities, a lot of these social determinants are for the same reasons people are incarcerated are almost the same reasons people are being infected with HIV. Drugs, homelessness, poverty. And it's more than just, you know, educating people on safe sex. Why aren't people practicing safe sex? What's going on in people's lives that, you know, especially in people that are poor?
And I do want to pick up on all that. Both you and Gary talked about men having sex with men, which is it means something, and I want to make sure our listeners understand. Jose, I'm back to you. What does that mean?
I think it was a term that was thought up by the CDC, if I'm not mistaken. A lot of guys don't embrace the word gay, or they're not part of that community. These are guys that don't fly rainbow flags. These may be guys that are living in really tough or rough neighborhoods that, you know, can't come to terms or are not able to come to terms with their sexual choices or preferences. So the Center for Disease Control came up with the term MSM, men that have sex with men.
Is that helpful, do you think? I mean, for us in terms of understanding?
I personally don't like the word because it involves, you know, it leaves out any kind of emotion or anything like that. It's just saying people have sex with men, you know, men having sex with men. But it's the truth. And it leaves out, it doesn't denote that healthy relationships do exist, which people need to know about, and maybe, you know, they wouldn't have to hide in closets.
Well, we need to take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. I know all three of you want to have more things to add. We are, frankly, getting a kind of an update on where we stand when it comes to HIV/AIDS. The voice you just heard is Jose DeMarco. He's a community organizer for ACT UP Philadelphia. Also with us, Ian Frank. He's director of the Clinical Therapeutics Program at the Penn Center for AIDS Research. And Gary Bell, executive director of Bibashi. That's a case management agency serving low-income people of color with HIV disease in Philadelphia. Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
I like to be in America.
The Man supports WHYY. On Wednesday, July 30th, West Side Story comes to life on the big screen with its electrifying score played live by the Philadelphia Orchestra. Winner of 10 Academy Awards, including Best Picture, with spectacular choreography and memorable songs, including Maria, The Jet Song, Tonight, and America. It's an evening for the entire family. Tickets at mancenter.org or 800-745-3000 or ticketmaster.com.
I'm Jesse Thorne. Mimi Pond is a cartoonist. Her new graphic novel / memoir is based on her time waiting tables at a diner in Oakland. It was the 70s, and her boss had very specific tastes in employees.
Hired people like he was casting an anarchic punk opera.
Mimi invites us into a world of profanity, drugs, and storage room trysts. On the next Bullseye from NPR.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY. I'm Jeremy Hobson. Jose Antonio Vargas went from journalist to activist when he revealed he was an undocumented immigrant, and this week he was detained at the border.
I've been very angry and lost and confused. All of these politicians are basically playing political football with our lives.
We'll talk to him next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Gary Bell, Ian Frank, and Jose DeMarco, getting an update and frankly taking stock of where we stand in the battle against HIV/AIDS, what it's like to live with the infection, and again, open lines at 1-888-477-9499. We're having a very interesting conversation off the air during that break, and Ian Frank, you were talking a bit about this men having sex with men, how perhaps as a researcher, that's actually a helpful phrase for you.
Well, as a researcher and a doctor, it's helpful for me because I can advise people to get tested for HIV irrespective of how people identify themselves. I can say to somebody, a man who has had sex with men, you need to be treated you need to be tested for HIV infection, and if you're positive, you need to be treated. But if I go to somebody and say, I'm talking to a group of people and I say, well, gay men need to be tested. Somebody may say, well, I'm not gay. They may have sex with men, but they may not identify themselves as being gay. So from my perspective, breaking it down to the behavior is really what's important in terms of risk and who should be tested. But I really want to say, we're talking about risk and who should be tested, everybody should be tested. The Centers for Disease Control recommends that everybody should be tested. You know, the conversation,
country.
Well, the CDC recommends that 15 to 65-year-olds be tested for HIV at least once, irrespective of how they call themselves, how they identify themselves, and who you're having sex with. Because women can get HIV infected too, and you could have one sexual partner and become HIV infected. And when we say, oh, this is a disease of men who have sex with men or intravenous drug users, we forget about the fact that there are a lot of other people who are putting themselves at risk, who get HIV infected, who don't get identified as being HIV until they present with very late disease because they're not identified as being in a risk group who should be tested. And I've seen people who present very late in their HIV infection who've had half a dozen encounters with other medical providers with conditions that should clue in that medical provider that this is somebody who should be tested for HIV infection. But they don't get tested because they're not in a quote-unquote risk group.
Gary, I remember one time you were a guest on the show, and what we were talking about was the increase of the number of women who were contracting or getting HIV/AIDS. How do women then figure into our conversation? We've been talking a lot about men.
Well, one of the modest successes we've had has been seeing at one point it was kind of a decrease, but it's sort of leveling off again. I mean, women are still getting infected, and they're the main people becoming infected through heterosexual contact. And I think it's very important when we talk about MSM, that just brings back the whole stigma and homophobia, and this is a gay disease. And we need to know, just for example, in Philadelphia, that 44% of new infections were in heterosexuals. And I think it was about 42% in MSM. So we need to be careful when we talk about it that it doesn't, you know, people don't come away with, well, it's a gay disease and I don't have to worry about it because I'm not gay. And that's especially true when the term MSM is helpful in some ways, and we've talked about how clinical it sounds.
Yes.
But we work with a lot of people who have been incarcerated. And many of them don't perceive themselves as having sex with men, even though they have sex with men when they're in prison. So it really gets complicated, and I agree with Dr. Frank that you really have to focus on the behavior.
And condoms? I mean, is condoms a first line of defense? Jose, you want to take that?
I wanted to piggyback.
No, go ahead. Gary
said. That was a campaign that ACT UP worked on and won again to make sure that condoms were available in Philadelphia jails. People, that are incarcerated may not put any sort of name on themselves, but we know that sex happens inside of jails. People just need human contact of whatever sort. And we knew that infections were taking place. How many were, we didn't know. But we had, yeah, condoms, especially in people that are in prison, are a first line of defense. So we made sure the condoms were available to those in those that were incarcerated. And also, we were talking about, I think someone mentioned IV drug users.
Yes.
Well, one good thing in Philadelphia, Prevention Point, I think, where the city's legal needle exchange, have actually driven down HIV infections. And needle exchange, crazy as is the only HIV prevention intervention that has been proven to work. And even though the ban has been lifted, and like 2 months later, I think the Republican Congress instituted it again. You know, it should be legal across the state for people to obtain sterile syringes.
Clean needles. Would you agree with that, Ian Frank?
Well, I think needle exchange programs are critically important in decreasing the epidemic among intravenous drug users. And the number of cases among intravenous drug users is down and is at, it can't be an all-time low, but it's as low as it's been since the mid-80s. I want to talk about condoms for a second because, first of all, condoms, they're the primary way individuals can protect themselves from becoming HIV infected, but they're only good when we're talking about, well, first, they're only good when they're used.
Right.
But they're only
used correctly,
they're,
I guess.
Yes.
Yeah.
But they're only good against insertive intercourse. And there are some people who say, I have not had any unrisky sex except for oral sex. People don't like to use condoms when they're having oral sex. And you can get HIV infected from oral sex. It's not as common. It's not as easy to acquire that way. But I've seen people who tell me, I haven't had any insertive intercourse for years, but I'm having unprotected oral sex. And they come in with newly diagnosed HIV, newly acquired HIV infection. So it's not only going to be condoms. And not everybody likes to use condoms. Condoms are not always available. We're talking about young people and sex. There's unwanted pregnancies. Those people are having an untoward consequence of sex. It's not getting HIV infected, right, but it's the same behavior. And young people, when they're in a social situation, may be attracted to people. Sex is a very emotional thing. It's about feeling good. It isn't about thinking,
9 months down the line.
Yeah, that's right.
Or a year or two.
This is going to happen to me. You know, they're thinking about feeling good at that moment. And that's what HIV acquisition is about. Feeling good, making not wise decisions, because you want to feel good right now.
Well, Gary, going back to you and actually you, Jose, as well. So how do we tailor a message so that those people who are engaging the kind of risky behaviors that we're talking about, they maybe think before that moment that Ian just described?
Well, one of the things that has we've been focusing more on, and I think the literature is starting to point that out, is that people aren't necessarily, particularly African Americans, we've been talking a lot about African Americans, aren't necessarily engaging in any riskier behavior than anyone else. They're not necessarily using condoms less, having more partners. A lot of it has to do with who they love, who they come in contact with. And certain people living in certain communities where there's a higher viral load are more likely to encounter someone who's HIV positive than someone that isn't. And that's especially true with African-American MSM. For example, an African-American MSM has a 39% chance of encountering, you know, having sex with someone who is HIV positive than even a white MSM is. So a lot of it has to do with where you live. A lot of it has to do with who you love, and not necessarily just the risky behavior, although risky behavior certainly is a determinant.
Let me just read a tweet, and then I'll toss this to you, Jose. This is from Califf. He says, do they think that the lack of mature public conversation about sex is preventing effectiveness of HIV prevention outreach? The fact that, while there's sex all over the culture, people don't seem to be able to have perhaps mature, honest conversations about sex. Is that part of the problem, do you think?
I believe that's true, yes.
Because why?
sex is always so stigmatized. I mean, sex is a wonderful thing, but, you know, sex should be sanctioned by marriage, should be sanctioned by the clergy. It's, you know, it's one of those things, I don't know, as far back as time goes, you know, sex is just one of those things that's forbidden. I guess it's because it feels good. I don't know, maybe people aren't supposed to feel good. But we're not having conversations, you know, real honest, frank conversations about, you know, sex, why people don't want to use condoms. And I think gay men, especially your MSM men, need to sit down and have conversations within their own communities about what it is, why there's a need to have someone ejaculate in you.
Ah, indeed.
You know.
Go ahead, Ian.
These are conversations we need to have with teenagers, with 12-year-olds, with 13-year-olds. We need to give them the knowledge to understand how to deal responsibly with sex. And we don't want to have these kinds of sex education programs in all of our school systems. We don't want to have honest conversations. We don't want to do anything that may make it sound like we're condoning sex at a young age. But it's the wrong approach in communities where sex is discussed more openly, particularly European communities. There's less unwanted pregnancy. There's less rape. There's more respect of individuals. There's less partner violence. We need to make it okay to have sex conversations amongst ourselves and with our kids and other young people that we talk to.
Well, let me quickly reintroduce the three of you. That's Ian Frank. He's director of the Clinical Therapeutics Program at the Penn Center for AIDS Research. Jose DeMarco is a community organizer for ACT UP Philadelphia. And Gary Bell is executive director of Babashi. That's a case management agency here in Philadelphia. Serves low-income people of color with HIV disease. And again, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes at whyy. And you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Gary, I'm back to you. And so how do we tailor this message? I was reading about that there's an AIDS app that's available or under development. People talk about the churches getting more involved. I don't know if that's an effective message giver when it comes to AIDS prevention and treatment. But how do we use, I guess, the institutions that we have or even the technology we have to address this issue?
Well, I think we have to use all of the above. I think it's something that should start early. Dr. Frank referred to sex education in schools, which is really like taboo for many. I was reading an article about how in the South, where HIV is particularly in rural areas, is really growing, and how there's such an emphasis on abstinence only that teachers can't even mention the word condom in schools. So I think we have to start early in educating young people about it, because they're feeling things. They're learning about their bodies. They don't know what's going on, and we're not guiding them at that time when I think it's crucial. So I think a lot of the emphasis does need to be on younger people in general. Mm-hmm. In Philadelphia, 40% of the new infections were in people from age 13 to 29 years old. So it's becoming younger. And we know social media is one way to reach younger people. So I think we have to meet people where they are in terms of the messages.
What do you think, Jose?
I think Gary's correct. And that's why I think there are condoms available maybe in 11 high schools, but they should be available in all public high schools, because we know kids are having sex. Young people have sex. Yeah, Gary's I really agree with
you. They should be available in private high schools, too, not just public high schools. Because I got news for you. You know, those kids are having sex, too.
No.
Let me ask you, Ian, because we've been talking about the obvious serious issue of HIV/AIDS, but there have been success stories, and I just want to make sure that we do that, including, as my understanding is, the mother-child transmission, that if a mother gets a drug cocktail while she's pregnant, there's a very good chance that her infant will be disease-free. Did I read that right?
That's correct.
Right.
If a woman is identified as being HIV-infected during her pregnancy, treating that woman with three drugs, getting her viral load undetectable, decreases the chance she's going to transmit her infection to her newborn to less than 1%.
Wow.
So it's another successful prevention strategy. like I said, treating individuals for HIV has been shown to prevent transmission to their partners. So if there's a discordant couple, one's infected, one's not infected, treating the infected person decreases the chance that that man or woman will transmit their infection to their partner dramatically. There are microbicides that are being developed, compounds, usually antiviral compounds, that can either be inserted into the vagina or the rectum as a gel, or into the vagina in a ring, and the medication slowly diffuses out of the ring and prevents HIV acquisition. There are studies of these kinds of products going on right now. Drug treatment is incredibly successful. Like I said, somebody can start on a therapy, remain on that same therapy with no side effects for decades. So there's a lot of success stories. We're talking now about curing people of their HIV. Just to mention the word cure and HIV in the same sentence without using the words there is no cure is a dramatic leap forward in this business. And we're doing research in Philadelphia and other places in trying to understand how we can cure people of their HIV infection.
Has anyone ever been cured? I was reading about, I think his name is Timothy Brown. Is
the Berlin patient?
The Berlin patient? Yeah. I mean, is that sort of a weird anomaly, or was someone actually cured?
Well, this is an extreme case. And so the Berlin patient is an American who was living in Berlin, got leukemia, got a bone marrow transplant, leukemia came back, got a second bone marrow transplant. And the key thing about the bone marrow that he received, it was from a donor who had a natural mutation in a receptor that HIV needs to bind to in order to enter a cell. Individuals, and it's about 1% of the population who have this mutation, can't get infected. It's a little bit more complicated than that. But for argument's sake, they can't get infected. So he gets a bone marrow from somebody whose cells cannot be infected by HIV. And so he stops his HIV treatment. He was on HIV therapy for a long time before he got leukemia and before he got the bone marrow transplant. He stops his therapy, and it's been years now, and his virus has not recurred. And he's had multiple large blood cell collections and tissue biopsies and analyzed, and there's no evidence of HIV anywhere in this guy.
Wow.
But he is one exceptional case, and people do not want to get a bone marrow transplant in order to get cured of their HIV infection because you can die of the bone marrow transplant. So this is not a way we're going to be curing people of their HIV. If you get leukemia, then you have HIV, then this is a strategy. But this is not going to be the kind of strategy we're going to use for the average person with HIV infection.
Well, let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation talking about HIV AIDS, where we stand in understanding the disease and some of the treatments that are in the works and some of the treatments that actually do work. And, of course, talking about prevention with Ian Frank, Jose DeMarco, and Gary Bell. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Again, send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back.
Holman Cadillac proudly supports WHYY. During Holman Cadillac Summer's Best event, over 200 of the season's collection of new and pre-owned Cadillacs are available for a test drive. More at Holman Cadillac on Route 73 in Mount Laurel, New Jersey, and online at HolmanCadillac.com.
On the next Fresh Air, our tribute to jazz bassist Charlie Hayden, who died last week at the age of 76. During his childhood, he sang mountain music on his family's country radio show, but he became famous for helping lead a jazz revolution as an original member of the Ornette Coleman Quartet. We'll hear interviews I recorded with him between 1983 and 2008. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
life's internal playlist.
There's a physical, spiritual, electrical experience that happens when you see a human being who wakes up, who comes to life.
The amazing story of how music and memory unlock the lost lives of patients with Alzheimer's, a new documentary, Alive Inside, next time from The Takeaway on PRI Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
PNC Arts Alive and Koresh Dance Company support WHYY and present the second annual Come Together Dance Festival, showcasing the creativity and diversity of Philadelphia's dance community, July 23rd through the 27th. For tickets, koreshdance.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen. It's been several decades since AIDS was first identified, and while there has been progress on treating and identifying the disease, there is still much to do. That's what we're talking about with our guests on Radio Times today. Jose DeMarco, a community organizer with ACT UP Philadelphia. Ian Frank, director of the Clinical Therapeutics Program at the Penn Center for AIDS Research. And Gary Bell, executive director of Bibashi. And you can give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Let me see what Eric from Collegeville has to say. Eric, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, everyone.
Hi there.
Thanks for talking about HIV and AIDS in such a frank and authentic way.
Sure.
I wanted to address a recent report by the WHO that advocated that MSM ought to consider getting on a Truvada or PrEP regimen prior to any sexual contact to limit exposure or susceptibility to exposure, and whether or not you saw that as an effective avenue of research and outreach.
I appreciate the call to Radio Time, something we wanted to talk about. Truvada, as I was described, as I read about it, pre-exposure prophylaxis. What are we talking about here, Ian? And then we'll get our other guests to weigh in on this.
Right. So we call it PrEP, pre-exposure prophylaxis. It means taking an HIV medication so that if you get exposed to HIV, there'll be drug in your system, and that can inactivate the virus and prevent infection from getting established. And there have been a number of studies that have been done in different communities, in MSMs, in heterosexual couples, and it's shown to be an effective strategy. The key is needing to take it every day, and some studies have shown positive results. In some studies, the drug hasn't worked because people haven't been taking it. And there's the perception of risk that's really key here. If I tell you, you got to take this medication every day to prevent yourself from becoming HIV infected, but you say, well, I'm really busy at work. I'm not going to have sex this week. Why would you want to take a medication that's not treating anything, it's a prevention, when you're not going to be putting yourself at risk? Now it's the weekend, you're going to be going out, now you start on the therapy again, but maybe the therapy is not going to be as effective if you only take it for a day or two, you know, before having sex and afterwards. These strategies, even though we call it PrEP, pre-exposure prophylaxis, if the virus has gotten into you and if some cells are getting infected and you're on medication, it's also what we would call post-exposure prophylaxis.
Right. Right.
Meaning that now the drug is having some kind of therapeutic effect, and maybe it can wipe out that little spark of HIV infection. So if people don't take this strategy the right way, then it isn't going to be effective, potentially. To try to overcome some of these obstacles, there are some longer-acting medications that are being tested right now in clinical research studies of injectable antiviral medications that will last for a month or, in one case, 3 months in people's systems. So this is the first start of this research. And there's a lot of controversies, and I'll let Jose and Gary speak to these, because there's some people who are concerned, well, if these kinds of treatments are available, then people are going to go crazy, and they're going to go out there and just have as much sex as they possibly can have because they're going to think, okay, now I got nothing to worry about.
Jose, you want to take that? Is that a concern you have?
I've been reading a lot about this the past couple of days, and I sort of looked at it from a perspective, if I could take a pill that would stop me from getting lung cancer, would I smoke? I mean, there's a lot of ways that I look at that.
You can think of it as like birth control as well, right?
Exactly. Yeah, I think any medication or any prevention for people that are at high risk, I'm for it. I know in communities of color, I wish this medicine was available for people at an affordable rate. This medicine should be available, and I think someone that runs a large international AIDS organization has called it a party drug. But I think they were thinking, I think they're stuck in 1992 when it was just only white gay men that were partying. There's so many people that can benefit from this drug. I mean, so many people in community, men, women, regardless of sexualities. This would be a wonderful thing, I think.
Well, and to you, Gary, one of the concerns that I read was that if people take this drug, then they won't use condoms, for instance. So they'll just think, okay, I'm protected here. I'm safe here. Where do you come down on this, Truvada?
Well, that is a concern. And the CDC is recommending that Truvada would work best, or PrEP would work best, in conjunction with, you know, safer sex, condoms, and so forth. And I think if it's done that way, that is optimal. But we know how people are, and we know that they won't always adhere to things. So I think it's one tool in our toolbox. I don't think it's the only thing. I don't think it's for everyone. But Dr. Franken mentioned serial discordant couples where one is HIV positive and the other is negative, where something like that especially will be very valuable in case they do get in the heat of battle, do not use a condom or something. So I think it's not for everyone, but I think it can be a very important tool in our toolbox.
I mean, we've been talking about some of these interesting breakthroughs, but, I mean, what about costs? You talked about this, Jose, which is, you know, can a low-income person in Philadelphia, can they access, can they pay for this? I don't even know whether the Affordable Care Act is you know, part of this payment solution. I'm looking at you, Ian, but I'd be curious.
So we're really lucky in Pennsylvania because how HIV care gets paid for differs by states. And in Pennsylvania, we've got a pretty generous system. So poor people can get medical assistance, and these medications are paid for through medical assistance programs. Also, the manufacturer of Truvada will make the drugs available. There's some paperwork that needs to be completed for individuals who don't have insurance.
Right.
There's a special pharmaceutical benefits program for people who don't have insurance that have HIV that will pay for the medications. So we can pretty much give these medications to anybody irrespective of the kind of insurance and what their income is.
I'm wondering, though, and Jose, you mentioned people who are homeless or, you know, just are I guess the difficulty of reaching people that just live sort of outside of the system.
And we have a really awful homeless population here in Philadelphia. The numbers have been manipulated, and so that it looks like the numbers have actually gone down, but that's something for another. Yeah, and the number of people that are homeless with HIV and AIDS, we don't know. We recently won a victory to get a housing survey of people with HIV and AIDS done, which hasn't been done since 1991. As of to this day, it still has not taken place. Mm. We know that in the past few years, homeless people have died on the street with AIDS. Had they been housed, I'm sure they would not have died. You know, it's just simple. You have a cabinet to put your pills in. You can get up each morning and take them. And we don't know how many people there are with HIV that are homeless. We don't know whether they get treated or even people getting tested. It's a real problem.
Mental health, if I can interrupt. Mental health is really important here. A lot of people who are homeless have mental health problems. And unfortunately, for reasons which I don't understand, we've sort of separated medical care and mental health care in our healthcare delivery system. So at the University of Pennsylvania, I can provide medical care, but some people who need mental health care, they can't come to the University of Pennsylvania to get their mental health care. They got to go somewhere else. And individuals who have mental health problems, they need simple solutions. We don't need to make the system more complicated. But I think a lot of the homelessness problems stem from mental health issues, and if we could address them, we'd really go a long way improving some of the homelessness, which does make it harder to deliver any medical care.
Indeed. Gary, anything you want to add to that?
Well, I think what we're talking about is just a lack of of coordination and communication with the different systems. We know with many people we work with, they enter the system in different places. Sometimes it's incarceration, it's medical care, it's mental health, it's substance abuse treatment. We have veterans, homelessness, and most of these systems don't really collaborate that much, and most of these systems don't talk to each other and coordinate services. So we have people falling in and out of care, popping up again in another area, and I think we would go a large way to kind of keeping people in care if these systems just talk to each other from time to time.
You want to add to that, Jose?
Yeah, I wanted to say here in Philadelphia, most of our housing money for people with AIDS comes directly from the feds. It's called HOPA. The city of Philadelphia does not contribute at all to housing homeless people with HIV and AIDS. And I think if we could find the street homeless first and house them first, I think we can make a big dent.
Get them inside so they have that medicine cabinet so they can put their drugs there and then use them. Let me get Ernie from East Windsor, New Jersey, to join us on Radio Times. Ernie, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, I'd like to know what would be the best strategy for a couple, a discordant couple, where one person has AIDS and one doesn't, if they want to get pregnant, if they want to have a child, and would there be a difference by which partner has the infection?
Is this someone you know, Ernie, or is this just a question that you've been thinking about?
It's an academic question.
It's an interesting one. And Ian, that's the ball's in your court, at least to start.
Right. So we face the situation not uncommonly. And what we do is the infected partner gets put on HIV therapy, and we get their viral load undetectable, and we keep it there for about 6 months. Then we tell the woman, okay, understand your ovulation cycle. Go to the drugstore, get an ovulation test kit, know when you're going to ovulate. Then you can have some unprotected sex around the time of ovulation. If the woman is uninfected and the positive partner is the man, then we can give pre-exposure prophylaxis to the woman for a few days around unprotected sex. We could give it to the man, too, if he's the uninfected individual. Then we say, okay, have unprotected sex for a few days around ovulation, and then you use condoms again. We see if the couple becomes pregnant. There are published studies on this that show no cases of HIV acquisition, and about 75% of couples conceive over the course of a year.
Fascinating. I appreciate the call, Ernie, to Radio Times. And again, you can call as well, 1-888-477-9499. Gary, and this is to you, Jose, as well. You both have talked about the problems of drug use or perhaps drug addiction. I was reading about meth and people using meth and Viagra together and that being a potential problem for contracting HIV/AIDS. Is that something you've seen, Gary?
It's something we've seen sort of anecdotally. I would say with many of the folks we're working with, meth is not necessarily the drug of choice, although many indulge in different things.
Right.
But certainly anytime someone does use a drug that alters their perceptions, alters their behavior, their inhibitions, they're putting themselves more at risk.
Because they're just not thinking beyond.
Especially it's a stimulant, and it's one of the things it's going to do is stimulate one's, you know, libido, and so I just think it's just another thing that we just hear about people, you know, using, and it comes back to the same things we've been talking about, you know.
Jose, you want to add to that?
I agree with Gary. In our communities, I don't see a lot of necessarily meth use as opposed to crack cocaine. That's, you know, meth use, I don't see nearly as much. It was a big problem for gay men a while back. I don't know how prevalent it is now. But in the community I live in, it's a cocaine crack problem that people don't talk about.
Another thing that people don't talk about, I guess.
Yeah, and something else, I think it's late in the show, but I meant to talk about injection drug users and hepatitis C, which is a really, really big issue. And there are treatments now available, which is great, but the treatment is like $84,000. And I don't know how much of Medicaid is actually picking that up.
Yeah, I'm looking at you, Ian, if you have an answer to that.
Well, again, you know, we can get most people treated, and sometimes there are some hurdles to overcome. I'm glad, Jose, that you bring this up, because we were talking about condom use, and everybody thinks about condom as HIV prevention. Mm-hmm. It's not just HIV prevention. It's hepatitis C prevention. It's general wart prevention. It's syphilis prevention. So the PrEP strategies are good for HIV, but they're not going to protect you from other things. So condoms are still an essential part of this discussion for prevention.
Well, we're almost out of time here. One of the reasons we wanted to do the show was the fact that there was this Mississippi baby who it looked like had become HIV free. And as it turned out last week, it turns out that she does have HIV. She was born to a mom who had, I guess, HIV AIDS. And a lot was made about this case, and now the fact that she tests positive raises a whole host of other questions. We mentioned cure, but does this case kind of throw the kibosh into some of the thinking about a cure or even a vaccine?
No, I would say, in fact, just the opposite. It gives us some interesting leads. It tells us that cure is going to be very difficult to achieve. So the story here is this. This woman with HIV gets no prenatal care. She delivers a child. The child is put on HIV therapy right following birth, a little bit more aggressive than you would treat a child who is not known to be HIV infected. The child tests positive for HIV by seeing the presence of the virus in the blood. Which means she got infected prior to birth.
Right.
Most kids get infected during birth. They don't test positive until about 1 month of age. This kid was infected in the womb.
And we have about 15 seconds.
So she gets put on therapy, viral load disappears, comes back after being lost to follow-up and stopping her medication after about a year and a half of treatment. And lo and behold, there's no virus detected. And now it's the child's almost four and
the virus
is back.
Well, on that note, my thanks to all three of you for joining us today in Radio Times. Ian Frank, thank you very much. Gary Bell, thank you very much as well. And Jose DeMarco, thanks for joining us. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes and you can find out much more about this program. In fact, we posted some photos on our Facebook page of our guests. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back.